I had the largest plume of smoke I've ever seen going out the door. I mean, they had 100 acres when they pulled up, and that's unheard of in Southern California.
California Burns, the podcast, is a property of the California Fire Prevention Organization, a nonprofit dedicated to promoting fire prevention and life safety throughout the state of California, notably in areas at risk, smaller rural communities, and places that typically don't get access to the type of support and programs we provide. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of California Burns, the podcast from the California Fire Prevention Organization about fire prevention in the state of California. We're going to be talking today more about wildfires. My name is David Barrett, and I'll be your host. As if 2020 could be even stranger, once again, we're dealing with new and incredible statistics related to wildfire in the state of California. Through the 8th of September, more than 41,000 wildfires have occurred in the state of California. In 2019, that number was about 35,380, and 4.7 million acres have been burned so far this year. That compares with only about 4.2 million the year previously. And think about that, only 4.2 million. As of the end of the first week in September, there were dozens of fires still burning in California, all the way from the northern border with Oregon down to the Mexican border. That's more than 800 miles of landscape. And there's no indication that this is going to go away in the years to come. There are a number of issues affecting how these wildfires come into play, including the issue of global warming, drought, and of course the incursion of people into the wildland-urban interface. It's known that nearly 90% of all wildfires are typically started by human beings or related to human beings, and that includes things like power companies, automobile accidents, fires in structures, other kinds of things that take place. Natural phenomena, which used to be exactly what we would look for when we heard about wildfires, include lightning. And this year, up north in particular, lightning did play a significant role as it relates to wildfires. Everyone is able to read what's going on in terms of which wildfire is burning here or there. So we're going to leave that to the ability of the media to share that with you. What we want to talk about are issues that affect us either in the prevention or the recovery stage as it relates to these wildfires. Each episode is going to bring you something new and different that you can relate to, that you can learn from, and that you can utilize in your own life. The California Burns digital book that was introduced just a month ago is filled with information that teaches people about wildfire. It's all seen through the eyes of the photographers that were there, the people who go out and put their own lives at risk when they are taking photographs, which they then will share. They're the storytellers behind the scenes as it relates to these fires. Now, there's a number of different types of people that take these photographs, and that includes professional photographers that work for media agencies, network news, cable news, that sort of thing. But there are also photographers who do it because they love photography and they're enthralled with wildfire. Today, we're going to talk with an interesting individual who combines both the firefighter side of the house, so to speak, and the photography side of the house. Rick McClure is a retired captain from the Los Angeles City Fire Department and is currently a captain with the La Habra Heights Fire Department. He has been photographing fires, notably wildfires, but all kinds of fires, since he was a boy. So he's definitely someone who understands not only the issues that firefighters face, but the issues that photographers face. And we need to learn more about that because more and more people are taking photographs of fires, and often they shouldn't be doing so. So the questions come up, are photographers putting firefighters at risk when they go out there to take photographs? Are they interfering with fire ground operations? Or is this an important part of the storytelling aspect so that we can all learn about what's going on with these wildfires? By the way, if you are interested in learning more about the digital book, you can go online to learn about it either at the Apple Bookstore or visit it on the web at www.californiaburns.org. So let's turn to Rick. We had a telephone discussion just a couple of days ago, and let's follow along as he tells us about this kind of dual identity that he has, firefighter and photographer.
So, Rick, I am really pleased that you could join us today to talk a little bit about the interesting double life that you lead. You have a decades-long experience as a firefighter, and you have an equally long history as a fire photographer. How is it that you can mix the two different kinds of careers, which are clearly interwoven?
Well, obviously, the fire service part of my life, working regular schedules, and when I'm on my off time is what I spend doing the photography. Both of those are huge passions in my life. But I've been doing it for a long time. I've been in the fire service for 45 years, and the photography a little bit longer because I started doing that before I got hired as a professional firefighter. But it's just what I love to do. And I'm out and about a lot. And it's not even about money. It's more about just capturing the action of the men and women that are out there doing the job on the front lines.
It seems that fires in California used to be very seasonal. And in Northern California, they used to refer to the Diablo winds, and in Southern California, the Santa Ana winds. But today, wildfires seem to be much more complicated than that. Is that true?
Yes, it is. As a matter of fact, if I look back on my life, it was always something that I personally waited for the end of September through October, November, were the Santa Anas. And, we typically would have major brush fires, and not every year, not every season, but it was a seasonal event. You could look at it that way. Nowadays, we're already double this year. We're already double in, in Southern California on brush fire responses and actual brush fires that we were last year. And that's unheard of.
Yeah.
I mean, the seasons, the years have been doing that. Maybe over the past 10 years, we've started to see an increase in brush responses, even in the beginning of the year, but not to the extent that we're having them now. As far as up north, yes, they do have the Diablo winds. They've got the, their biggest problem up there is when they get the weather, not so much the winds, but they get the lightning, and they get a lot of lightning strikes, and they get a lot of brush fires. Obviously, the way that's happening nowadays is, again, that's also changed. You're seeing it more year round, but they're getting more massive destruction fires, just like the ones we've just recently gone through. Yeah, it was big down here. We had the lake fire, and yeah, it covered a lot of area, but it fortunately didn't damage or destroy a lot of property, a lot of vegetation, yes, but not personal property like homes. And it did have its significance. But up north, unbelievable, just thousands and thousands of acres. And you go back a few years and you talk about the fire up in Redding that took out a little portion of their town, and I went to that fire. But the Paradise fire,
sure,
killed, I believe, like 89 people in the town, and decimated the town. And where's that coming from? Why are we having that? I don't know. It's just the way that the weather has changed, the global warming, if you will, or whatever it is that's causing that. has really impacted the fire seasons around California proper.
It does seem that if we went back 40 or 50 years ago, that wildfires were natural disasters. And the lightning strike-based fires in Northern California from the past couple of weeks, 11,000 lightning strikes in just a 72-hour period, does still qualify as, for the most part, as a natural disaster. But at the same time, it seems that most of the significant wildfires that we face are now man-made, and not just from like PG&E or power grid-related things, but the fact that we have people living in places that used to be natural habitat that we have built and maybe overbuilt so that there are homes everywhere, and often with only one road in and out of that location. Do you think that the fact that we're building everywhere has an impact on this, or is that just hearsay?
No, I think it does. You know, you're adding more people to the mix. If you want to take it away from the different utility companies that have been hammered for power lines dropping, I mean, that happens. You know, things get frayed, things get old, and whatever it is that causes them, like the Saddle Ridge fire we had a couple of years ago up here in Southern California, that was by a down power line, and it happens. It happens around, you know, around the state or the country for that matter. You've got a lot of these, what we call urban campers, people who don't have homes anymore, who build their little nest eggs inside of these, what they would consider protected from the weather, so to speak, in and amongst the bushes and the trees. And, you know, they have their little campfires all the time. And we, in down here, at least in LA, we see a lot of that daily, fires all the time alongside the freeways, and their vegetation fires are not really going anywhere per se, but they do destroy, you know, the vegetation that's there. And, you know, some of these people do live up in the hills, and then you've got the people who are just not paying attention, if you will. Fire in Azusa, a Duarte area, I believe, a few years back started, they caught these three guys that have been camping overnight. They had a campfire, and they, you know, the brush lit off, and they actually were able to catch them or arrest them. You know, they started a huge brush fire, damaged a couple homes, and, you know, that, but we're seeing that. It's, so it's not all just, you know, the lightning and the power companies. It's also man-made. You get fires. We get a lot of these fires along the freeway systems up here in like Santa Clarita in the northern part of Los Angeles County. Truckers driving along the freeway. It's hot. Their truck overheats. Cars, they overheat. Where do they pull over? On the shoulder. What's next to the shoulder? Hillsides. And they take off. And you get some very substantial fires. The thing up here, though, in the northern part, is it's pretty much all vegetation. It's not moving into a residential area, such as the Lake Fire. The Lake Fire started kind of halfway between, for anybody that's familiar, between Castaic Lake and the top, which is Lake Elizabeth, you know, the northern part of it. And it was, when I left my house for that fire, within 5 minutes, I had the largest plume of smoke I've ever seen going out the door. I mean, they had 100 acres when they pulled up, and that's unheard of in Southern California to have that much going in an urban interface area where there's lots of people. Now, granted, Lake Hughes Road is kind of a non, you know, it's a long, open two-lane road that, you know, people just really don't typically travel during the middle of the day, you know, going to work in the morning, coming home at night. Yeah, they'll use it. But this was right in the middle of the afternoon. And, you know, look at what it did. I mean, they lost homes and they lost some vehicles and, you know, personal property. But for the most part, it wasn't anything close to the Bel Air fire, you know, 61 that we had. 484 homes were destroyed. And that's the urban interface, though, part of it. That's people want to live in a mountain area. It's nice. It's a convenient. It's or maybe not convenient. It's away from everybody.
Sure.
And that's what they like. But the thing is, they're putting themselves at risk, because when these fires roll through, you never know how many resources. Fortunately, we have lots of resources available to us immediately. But the fire spreading as fast as some of these do, especially a wind-driven fire, you can't protect everybody's home, and you're going to lose property. There's no doubt about it.
Of course, anyway. You are.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the photography aspect of what you do for a couple of minutes.
Okay.
You love taking photographs. This started when you were a boy, apparently. And do you remember what your very first camera was like and how you used it?
I actually started chasing fire engines when I got my bicycle. My mom used to take me on calls. We'd hear the sirens and jump in the car and chase them. No radios, no scanners back in those days, you know, just listening and following. As I got my first bike, I was 8. By the time I was 11, I had a little Kodak Instamatic camera and an 8mm movie camera that I carried around on my bike. And I had I was given by a fireman that was retiring his uniform. So when I'd hang out at the fire station, I'd wear the uniform on those days. I had a belt and buckle and just no badge yet. But I would go out and I would just shoot pictures. Nothing really. I mean, I, you know, save things, but nothing to write home about. But as I got older, started driving, that afforded me a little bit more of an opportunity to get around. And I finally, in 1969, I had met a very, you can call him, famous photographer from the LA Times, who became my mentor, and that was Boris Yarrow. And through him, I was able to acquire my first camera, which is a Nikon. And I sold my first picture to the Daily News for $5, which way back then it used to be called the green sheet. And I was off and running. It was black and white photography back then in that realm of the 35mm camera. But I still have my little Instamatic and the video camera. I didn't do a lot with those because now I was getting into the world of black and white. And through time, I was shooting up a storm, and I eventually got a second camera and was able to do both. So, but what I ended up doing was more the color or the black and white photography, because the news media and the news outlets, the Times, the Herald Examiner, the Daily News, they didn't do color. It was all black and white back then. And so that was where the money was for me, you know, to make a buck, pay for gas or whatever. That's what I did. So I've acquired, and I've got everything from when I pretty much started out from back in the 60s. I've got all my negatives and pictures or whatever you want from back then. And then I kind of moved forward, and as years went on, I started shooting a little in the video world. But again, I found that there was money in that, a little bit more money, as a matter of fact. But you know, it was still the still video, the still camera, the still pictures was still the passion. Running around to the different news stations back then to try and make some money was kind of awkward. It was difficult, you know, to go from Channel 7 to Channel 5 to Channel 9 and try and do that, where the Times was downtown. Yeah, I'd go down there. They'd walk me through, and I was able to learn how to process and do all that. Well, I did that at home too, but when I went down there, they actually gave me the key, so to speak, to go in, just go in and develop it. And then pick out a couple of pictures. They'd look at them and say, yeah, those are good. Okay, go in and print them. So I learned through that, and then I'd give them to them, and they'd create the little write-up on it, and away I went. Daily News was more convenient. It was in the valley. I just go drop off my roll, and they'd run it across the alley to Ralph Samuels Photography, because they didn't have their own people at that time. And they develop it, print it, whatever. And the next day, if I saw it in the paper, that was good. I was going to make some, a little bit of cash. But that's kind of how that went through the years. And now I'm shooting all color. I don't shoot any black and white. Of course, it's, you know, there's no reason to, because you can make a black and white out of color.
Sure.
But everybody uses color. Plus, on top of that, I shoot for on scene TV. So I'm shooting video as well. I don't do a lot that way. We have within the company, we have our own people dedicated to do that are actually trying to make money, trying to live, so to speak, off of what they do. I'm not doing that. I do it for the love of what I do. And a lot of this goes back to the fire department. And I'm sure you're well aware, you know, you see, and I don't think many people really post videos to the fire department Flickr site, but I'll give them video and pictures. You know, it's nice because people can look back, the guys and gals out there doing the job, look at that stuff. And I get calls, you know, hey, can you send me a picture? You know, I'll pay for it. I don't charge firemen anything. I just, if they want something and they contact me, I do that. But, you know, it's just, it's kind of funny because of all the pictures I shoot out there and all the members that are getting notoriety, if you will, very few of them ever contact me. And I think that you'd want to do that. You build up your album. And of course, being in that business when I got hired, being a photographer and knowing, you know, I was always collecting pictures from anybody that shot a picture of me. And it was just a little side note here. When I crossed over to the firefighter side in 93, I was at 105's on the truck, and I'd gotten off my first week on the job out of the drill tower. I was on my way home, and they sent me a message, text me or whatever they did, and said, hey, got a sod day if you want to work. So I said, yeah, I'll go back and work. So went back, grabbed my stuff. I went from 105's in Woodland Hills up to 96's. I was detailed for EMT training, so I had to cover for a firefighter. So I went to 96's for the day. The captain on the truck, and they put me on the truck as the roof. So the captain on the truck was way back when I was chasing on my bicycle, was a firefighter at 60's on the rescue, and I knew him very well. Well, I had my first fire that day. We pulled out of quarters on a structure, and I saw it before they did, believe it or not, because I knew exactly where to look just because of my knowledge of the city. And when we pulled out, boy, my eyes were already, and it was a huge loom up. It was a two-story house, pretty much fully involved. We had one fatality. It was a self-immolation inside the house. Well, nonetheless, I grabbed the ladder. I said, okay, the AO, the apparatus operator, said, okay, let's pull this ladder. So I pulled we didn't go to the 35 right away. I think we pulled a 24 off the truck, and I'm all suited up, all decked out. And the rigs, the engine 107 and truck 96 came nose to nose in front of this structure. So as I kind of glanced over to my shoulder, as we're going down the sidewalk to head to the back of the house, I noticed three photographers on the ground. They were kneeling down and they were shooting pictures. The house was on fire and they were shooting pictures. I went going, you know, as I was moving quickly by. Well, 2 days later, I went on a call, and it was an overturned trash truck. Boris showed up and I showed up. He said, hey, take it to the office. Go ahead and turn it in. He goes, I'll turn my stuff in, but, you know, we'll see if we can get you a shot. So I went in there and I saw the guy. I didn't know who he was. He was a new photographer to the Times. He was there just working in the office. And I asked one of the other photographers I know real well, Joel Lugaver. I asked him, I said, hey, that was the guy that was shooting pictures of the fire. He said, yeah. He goes, I saw pictures of you. And they had just gotten into color. And he said, you're a fireman now, right? And I said, yeah, this is my first fire. Well, interesting, because they did. They had a picture of me with the ladder going by. You can see the movement of me and the house on fire in the background. So he printed up some pictures. Firemen typically don't get pictures taken of them at their first fire. You know, when I was on at La Habra Heights, where it, I'm still a fire captain. We went to the Thomas Fire. We took a strike. We were part of a strike team. I had three guys with me, three younger members who were firefighters. They're volunteer firefighters. I'm a seasoned captain. And I took these kids. It was almost like a 14-day camping trip. We took them up there, fought fire and everything. And there's a picture of me, and I'm on a line. I'm actually on a hose line, all decked out, you know, in my brush stuff. And they had to get a picture. But anyway, you know, the photographers don't get their pictures taken very often, especially in that arena. But, you know, you don't find the two people together. In other words, you don't find two in one, so to speak. Like, I'm a fire photographer, but I'm also a firefighter. Where do you find that? There have been a few out there, but not to the extent that I have been, that I know of. You know, they're still active, that still do, that's still on the line, so to speak. So maybe other cities, but, you know, not with LA.
Yes, not with LA. That's certainly something that I've heard multiple times. So Rick, take us through a photography session on a wildfire. You're listening to a scanner, or you're monitoring what's going on through whatever means you have, and you hear that there's a dispatch, a full brush assignment someplace. Take us through what happens from the point of view of being that photographer and what you're looking for when you go out there.
Okay. There's two options here that I would have. One is I'm at home and I have radios at home to monitor, plus a paging system for LA County. So if certain, depending on what channel I'm monitoring, certain battalion chiefs get dispatched, or the say the dozer team or the helicopters, they get toned out for a response, I get that when they do. But it's also with the radio system, the simulcast or the broadcast of the dispatchers putting it out over a radio. Then if you have either a regular handheld radio or you have a scanner, you're picking that up when the dispatch goes out too. So there's multiple ways. So that's at home, or I'm out at night usually, because it's just because there's really nobody out there at night per se that's shooting, other than stringers, people who are trying to make money, but the news media per se isn't running their vans out there at night. They're not paying their people to stay out late at night. But they do stuff during the day and they get out during the day. And obviously if something big breaks, they take off, but you know, they get an assignment, so to speak. So I'm either in the car monitoring, where I will sit out at night and stage at a couple of different places, but where I'm fairly freeway close and close to what is considered an active area for fire or even law enforcement. Cause I'm not just fire. I'll go to shootings, traffic accidents, any type of emergency that I think is worthy of maybe capturing the action, I will do that. So the run comes in, the dispatch goes out, I'm listening, the tones go off. Okay, I know it's a brush response. Okay, next thing is, where is it? The other option that anybody has, if they have a phone, a cell phone, is pulse point, which is not necessarily meant to be for us to be out chasing fires or accidents, but it's an information system that's been developed for basically getting somebody to that's close by to somebody having a heart attack that may need CPR. Nonetheless, they when calls come into the dispatch centers, wherever they are, if they have that pulse point option, these calls come in, and sometimes I'll get a notification of a brush run or a structure fire or traffic accident before the dispatch goes out. It's, you know, and it depends on the area. County, there's usually a delay. So I'll hear the dispatch, then I'll, you know, a minute later, this will come out. The city, it seems to come out usually before or right at the time of dispatch. It just pops up on your phone, you know, notification, and it tells you where and when, and then you can navigate to it. Pretty awesome. Anyway, so the call goes out. I decide, am I going to go or not going to go? And one of the things that I have done over the years with, say, mentoring other photographers, younger people that have gotten into the business or want to be in the business, the thing I tell them is, when the bell goes off, you have to go. You can't sit and wait to hear a size up and then make a decision, oh, now I'll go. You can always turn around and go back. No different than the fireside. You launch the assignment. It may be nothing. It may be a very small fire that's handled with one resource, but you've got eight resources rolling to this thing. Okay, why? Because the call came in a way that dictated that. The dispatch center, or the CAD, so to speak, sent it out that way. But you know what? You can always turn back. But if it's something big, you want those people there. So no different, brush fire. So I launch. I see the header or the loom up, depending on what agency you're working for. It's in the sky or it's in the air. You know, the different terminology for showing or for saying I have smoke showing. And, you know, if you've got smoke showing, like on the lake fire, that much, I know I've got a huge fire. So I roll in. I'm trying to think of access. What's my best access? I don't like to be in the way. There's a lot of people out there that are now shooting pictures. And the lake fire was a perfect example of that, where they tried to, they did a, not a May Day, but they were blasting the horns. Everybody was getting out of Pine Canyon because it was lighting up. And the chief that was up there was yelling and screaming on the radio. He was telling dispatch to call law enforcement. There had to have been 30 to 40 cars, just photograph people with cameras. So I'm looking for the best access to get me in, usually to the point of origin, or if there's a threat to homes and I can get around that fire, I'll go to where the threat is for the homes. And because that's where you're going to deploy your resources, and that's where they're going to do the protection. And that's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for firefighters that are protecting, that are actually pulling hose, squirting water on flames or impinging on residences or businesses, vehicles, whatever it is. Whatever it is that the property that they need to protect. Vegetation, let it go. It's going to burn. Okay. You get air support. They handle the stuff back in the back country, you know, for the most part. But if it's impinging, that's what I want. That's what I want. That's the action I'm looking for, because you're going to get air support over that. You're going to have the firefighters, the fire engines, you know, everybody doing their job. That's the depiction I want to put out there for the people, you know. And here again, the media, the news media, whoever I move it to, picks it up. And, you know, and I'm not the only one. I mean, other photographers show up. But I will tell you that it seems like I'm pretty much the first photographer on scene of most of these incidents. And I know for the last 50 years, the thought on some people's minds is, how is he always there so quick? Why is he always there first? Because they know. You see the pictures, you see my videos, you see the companies rolling in, and I'm already there. How is that happening? Well, it's just because I go when the bell goes off, and I know where I'm going, and that's just the way it is. It's always been that way with me. So, like I said, I'm looking for the action. Maybe people moving out, trying to get their stuff packed up and out of the area, anything like that. So I try and stay, I guess if you want to call it, stay ahead of the fire. Yes, I'll go to the immediate location if I can get there. And that's like with the lake fire. I went to the point of origin first, or what I thought was the base of the fire, Alpha Division, whatever you want to call it. But it wasn't affording me the pictures I wanted. And this fire, it was already moving. So I had to leave where I was. And it was a long time. It took me a long time because of the roads to go all the way back around. A little different than being in the urban interface, like up in the Bel Air, Beverly Hills area, or Griffith Park. Easier to get around. Eagle Rock, anywhere you want to name, in the where we have the mountains here in Southern California that are where people live. Streets are easier to get around per se because there's more of them. Up in the mountainous area, the lake fire, it's only a couple ways into that fire, and there are long ways to get around. If I can get that shot, and I did on the lake fire, I've got stuff burning and there's no firemen around. But it's very intense fire and you can hear it. Somebody was watching my video the other day and they commented on it because I've got the crackling as the brush is burning or the trees are burning. And it's like, is that the sound from the fire? And I said, yes, that's it. Just, it's a roar. It's very intense. And this fire was very interesting because of how fast it was moving and the intensity of it and the wind that it was creating. At one of the points that I was at the west end of the fire at one point, and I've got it on video. I mean, the wind it's howling, it's circling around, like almost like tornado-like winds that are just, the fire is just feeding off of that. And it's starting fires, you know, across the road from behind me and everything. Just very, very intense. And I've been to many brush fires, and this one was different in that sense. Anyway.
Well, when you are out on the fire ground, because you have experience as a firefighter and as a fire officer, what goes through your mind in terms of protecting your own safety?
For me, the safety is watching the fire activity, watching the weather, if there is weather, paying attention to the wind direction, and what kind of fuels you have and what kind of breaks you have, where you can go. I don't want to have to look for a way out, if that makes sense. I want to know that I'm not in that zone, even though I will be putting myself in that position at times. Lake fire was kind of one of them. But I always look at to see where I can go. Where's that fire? What's the end of the fire? And then can I get out of there if something were to happen? But I don't want to put myself in the position of that. Yes, I protect myself. I've got brush gear. I wear a brush jacket. I can wear a helmet. I have one. I've got, you know, a hood if I need to put that on that I keep in my brush jacket. I can put on brush pants, boots. I've got the stuff I need. One thing I do carry, but I don't put it on myself, is a brush pack per se that has the shelter, the fire shelter with it. Reason being, I don't ever anticipate, yes, it's in the car, but I don't look at it because of my background and knowledge. I don't look at it as putting myself in the position to where I would ever have to deploy a shelter. I'm not getting out. I get out of my car to shoot pictures, but I don't go running up in the hills to capture the firefighters that are on the lines up there. Because we all been there. We know. You've seen it. I've seen it. How many firefighters have died from being in an area where there's a wind shift and all of a sudden now the fire's on them and they've been overrun? It's not my take. I can get stuff from the street where my car is, where I can be safe and get out of there. And I don't go into smoke. That was one of the things at the Pine Fire where I drove through it. Well, the time I was going to turn back and go back the other way, the smoke was ground level. The fire was whipping through there. I didn't go back out that way. I went around and took a long way around through Lancaster, Palmdale, through the desert, through the floor, which the fire had already was burning towards, and came back around the other way just to get to the other end of the fire because I didn't trust the road and the other people on the road that I didn't want to come head on into, which I've seen that. I've been there before where I've got pictures of. Head-on collisions, people trapped because they're trying to drive or escape the fire, but so much smoke they can't see, you know, the hand in front of their face, and they don't know, and they're trying to watch the yellow line. Well, what are they doing? So is the other car coming the other way. And that happened in Malibu years and years ago. I saw that head-on collision, there's blood all over the place because I got there after the fact, but it was sitting in the middle of the street. Fire, the cars are on fire. They're, you know, they'd already burned over and I was moving on. But so I know by that, and I watch this fire behavior because I have that experience.
It's important from a historical point of view. It's sometimes important from a training point of view. And it's certainly important relative to storytelling. But at the same time, fire departments, many of them, not all of them, but they look at fire photography and the people who take those photographs as being more of a hazard than a benefit. So it's kind of a interesting, challenging situation where you've got people who have a passion for it typically and think that they are good with their camera so they can get good photographs, but they don't necessarily understand the standard firefighting orders, watch out situations, you know, any of the things that an incident response pocket guide is going to be teaching a professional firefighter. And so they're creating a challenge for their own love of photography. Is what happens? How do we? What could happen to improve the relationship and the preparedness of fire photographers who are eager to take these types of photographs?
You know, in the as you mentioned, the watch out and the standard fire orders. I actually have a pocket guide in my car. Which is pretty thick, and it's, and I also have an incident management team book, and not that I go through that. I mean, they're guides, but I know the majority of that, and I can always refer to it if I need to. But here again, for me being on the fire ground, I have the opportunity and the knowledge with those or behind that, and so those I try and follow that as best I can to keep myself safe. And with the other photographers that are out there that don't have that, I'm not sure that you can ever corral everybody together in a meeting and talk to them and say, hey, look, here's what we need to do. Like I said, things have changed over the years. And one of the Netflix shows that's on there depicts on-scene TV, Loud Labs and RMG, which are all companies that engage in videography of incidents. And then, but what that is, it sparks people, younger people per se, that, oh, this is kind of neat. I can make money. I can go sell pictures or movies, videos to the news stations, because look at these guys. And that show shot in the dark. I don't know if you've seen it, but there's multiple, there's like 8 episodes. I'm in 2 and 4, number 2 and number 4, but it depicts what we do out there as, and I'm going to take it away from the firefighting part of it, or being a firefighter, but you learn stuff as you go. And like my guys in my group, the one, especially in the Valley that kind of tags along with me, or I tag along with him, we'll go to brush fires and I'll tell him, hey, come on up, let's go. I want a second person, but I've also taught him a lot about the fire service in general, about going to fires. The county fire department has a volunteer fire photographer program, and there's probably about 50 people roughly that are in that. It's no different than LAFD's program that they had. Well, they never really had anything like that. You could request and get a fire line pass, and that would allow you access beyond where the normal, the Joe citizen, so to speak, can get into. That program kind of went away. They kind of disbanded that, and they brought on somebody that could organize it. Well, they did that, and then it had an organization of people, of younger people. They couldn't go out to fires and sell pictures. Okay, could only be for the benefit of the fire department, not for their own personal gain. And we've had discussions. They'll bring in somebody and talk about brush fire safety. So before the season starts, we have meetings a few times a year, usually, and they'll go over stuff like that. And I know that Greater Los Angeles Press Photographers Association, that group, which I'm part of, I've been a part of that for 40 years. They also hold meetings like that. And they'll bring in somebody from the outside, a professional brush guru, if you will, from one of the agencies, and they'll talk. Or like they'll bring in Eric Scott, and he'll talk about safety issues out on the fire ground to the media photographers who are out there doing the job. I always park my car to get away, not going into it. So I'll turn around. If I have to park on the side of the road or whatever, I'm turned around ready to go the other direction. So if something were to happen, change of direction on the flames, fire, impingement, I'm out.
Tell me about some of the most important fires that you photographed.
Okay, I got to rack my brain a minute because, David, I've been to so many.
History kind of finds a place for that fire. So Bel Air with the loss of 484 homes is a good example of a fire that if you're involved in the fire service, you know about that fire.
Right.
The station fire is a more recent fire that, you know, if you're in the fire service, you know about that fire.
Right.
So in the Southern California area, there have been some interesting wildfires. In fact, a few in the last couple of years where maybe the fire department thought, oh, we got a handle on this, and all of a sudden it runs away from them and a lot of homes are lost or something. So that's what I will.
Yeah. Okay. I've been to obviously a lot of fires, and I could name different ones, but in a different position, not so much as a photographer, but knowing about them. But the one that probably most recently that was very devastating was the Getty fire.
There you go.
And the Getty fire. And that was the one that we had back in November last year. And that was where I was at home. I'd come home early that night, and it was about 1 o'clock in the morning. The bell went off. And I heard it, I mean, obviously, and I thought, you know what, do I want to start for that fire? And I decided to, and I was on my way down there from Santa Clarita, which is a little bit of a ride for me, but I'm on my way down there, and the first engine said, yeah, we got nothing showing. I don't see anything. Do you have anything further? And I thought, okay, well, and right after that, Battalion 10 got on the radio and said, Metro from Battalion 10, I've got 3 to 5 acres running uphill, blah, 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 off of Sepulveda there, Getty. And he had with high winds and the fire's moving at a rapid rate of spread and give me whatever he said, 10 more engines right off the bat. Now, why that engine company didn't see that, I don't know, because he was ahead of the chief. But as it stands, you know, so I was already on the move. I got there, start out on Sepulveda, but knowledge and background told me, watching this fire, and I was getting a lot of video on the front side, rigs coming up back and forth on Sepulveda. Some were going up to Mountain Gate, which is quite a ways from the fire, but they were trying to figure out, where's this thing going? Well, Rick's knowledge told Rick that it's going over into the Brentwood area, over off of Tiger Tail and Chelan and Kenter and all those. I thought, you know what? It's going that way, over towards the school. So I left our guy, Steve, who's the Metro guy, I left him on scene there at the Sepulveda thing because he didn't have any clue. I said, hey, I'm out of here. I'm going to the other side. So he says, oh, okay, you know. And I didn't say why. I just said, I'm sure the fire's moving. Well, I went in there and went up Kenter, I believe it was, and I got to the end, almost the end there, and there were a couple rigs parked there. But the fire was coming in. Next thing you know, I mean, it wasn't over the ridge yet, but as soon as it came over the ridge, I had a spot fire on the other side of the street, right behind a home. And within 2 minutes, that with spot fire was probably a 20 by 20 spot fire. It was moving. And I couldn't see the top of the fire. I was at kind of the south end of where that fire was spotting to. But it was gone. It was to hell and gone. And it was already moving over towards Tiger Tail on the top end. And they were evacuating the school and everything was starting to line up. So I went up into another section up off of, I'm pretty sure it was Tiger Tail I was on. And I'm above the canyon because it's one of these roads that goes above. And if you look on both sides where the homes are, everything's down below them. So the fire was down there and it was coming up with a rage. And I had companies lining the street, you know, a few companies that were taking homes. And then all of a sudden, homes started burning. And there I was right in the middle of it. And then there was a power pole that was lit in front of me, my only way out, because Tiger Tail is a dead end. And I thought, gosh darn, I need to get out of here. I'm going to forfeit the fire activity to get myself out of here. Now, they can stay. They were safe. They weren't going anywhere. They were going to be in the firefight. But for me, to be able to gain access, once those lines come down, I'm dead in the water. So I saw that, shot a couple quick pics of it, video, a little quick video, and boom, I was gone because I know what could have happened. So I was out of there. None of the other photographers had gotten up there yet. So they start showing up because they're listening to it on the radio. But that was close for me. That was something that, but it was another very significant fire because of the fire behavior and how it was moving and the wind. And again, because I was shooting video, you can see the burning embers and the, you know, and that's one of the things that people don't understand is the fire cast. Now they're calling it casting embers, new terminology in the fire service out here, and ember cast. But if you don't know that and the wind's blowing, you are going to get burned. These embers are flying all around. You don't really notice them per se because you're focused on a building that's on fire or a firefighter doing something, pulling hose. And these things are dropping all over you, dropping down your neck and wherever. And it's unbelievable, you know. But that fire was a very, very interesting fire. And obviously for me, it lasted through the night because I was there until morning. I had to send my stuff out, turn around, come back, and I shot more stuff. I went around the mountain gate. I got up there where I wanted to be inside and on a plateau, and the air tankers, the heavies were coming through. So that was a very significant fire in that I had homes burning around me. And unlike the Bel Air fire, because I was only 8 years old, I saw that Bel Air fire when it first started, and my mom was taking me to school, and I looked over, it was 8:15 in the morning, and I looked over, I dropped a letter in the mailbox for her, looked towards Ventura and Laurel Canyon from where I used to live, and there was a plume of black smoke, and I thought it was the food giant market on fire, and I wanted her to take me to the fire, and she wouldn't. I had to go to school, and I sat there. I was in a second floor classroom upstairs that the window faced the fire, faced to the west, and I couldn't do anything in school that day except sit there and keep looking out the window at that thing as it was growing. And then they had the second fire in Topanga, another huge fire in the city. But see, nobody knows about that because they don't follow that. They only know about Bel Air. But if you ever read the book, not Designed for Disaster, because that's the movie, but there's a book, and I have it. And it was a little yellow paperback that they put out. And it talked about the fire behavior or what happened before and after, just like the movie. Anyway.
Well, this has been an interesting discussion. And I'm grateful for the time that you've shared with us. I can tell you that your photographs, a single image, can sometimes share as much dialogue as we've had if people are willing to really look. People often see things, but they don't really look at them. And your images tend to make people want to look.
And thank you.
And I'm grateful for the work that you do. And I hope that you have many years of successful photography ahead of you. And I'm glad you were part of the California Burns Volume 1 book. It's an interesting manuscript related to wildfire, and it would not have been as well put together as it has been without your involvement. So thank you very much.
I appreciate it. Thank you, David.
So that interview covered a lot of different topics, all related to wildfire and firefighting. But you should know that Rick's personal opinion also has some weight as it relates to some of the things anyone should be thinking about when it comes to wildfire and photography. First of all, nobody should be taking photographs of wildfire anywhere close to a contained fire operation zone without proper access and credentials. And that also means proper protective gear. Nobody should think about ways in which they could penetrate the different boundaries set up by highway patrol or local law enforcement, thinking that they've achieved some kind of success at getting access to something that the ordinary person doesn't have access to. You're not only putting yourself at risk if you do that, but you are potentially requiring firefighters to stop doing what they are there to do, which is to suppress and put out the fire, and now they have to think about rescuing you. Life is always much more valuable than property, but putting other people's lives at risk is just irresponsible and selfish. So if you're interested in fire photography, well, there are books like the California Burns book and many others. There are news accounts as each fire is explored, both during the fire and afterwards. And if you're interested in doing it, then there are ways to learn about becoming qualified and becoming prepared. Anyone who interferes with firefighting operations is not only potentially breaking the law, but they are also creating a bad name for those photographers that spend their own time and money and effort to be properly prepared, to understand how to be safe, and to stay out of the way of firefighting operations. Having said all of that, the images that Rick has been able to create, as well as many other photographers, some of whom we'll talk to in the coming weeks, is just amazing. These images often explain clearly the direction that a fire is heading, the danger related to whether it's a structure involved or wind-driven or terrain-driven. Images can be extremely powerful. They can also be very useful to not only fire departments and city agencies and elected officials, but to researchers who want to study exactly what's going on with any particular fire. As an example, if we look at, you know, back at the beginning of the year, there was some fear early on in the year that 2020 would be a significant and dangerous year for wildfires. And that's because it was so extremely dry during January and February. We know now that the season is actually a year-round activity, that the former period of time of late September through the end of November is no longer valid, that wildfires are taking place throughout the year, and they are getting worse for a number of reasons, which we will investigate in the coming weeks in different podcasts. We do know that wildfires have been getting worse and worse year over year, but they often were at least this bad if we look back a couple hundred years. A number of researchers have discovered that maybe an average of 4.5 to 5 million acres would burn annually in the 1850s and 1860s. Some of those fires would burn for months, but it was a natural phenomenon that was kind of a cycle of clearing out dead trees and dead brush and all of the things that can be refreshed and renewed. And of course, there were not lots of homes and highways and people in the way of those fires. Fire policy is an important part of understanding wildfires, and CAL FIRE spends a lot of effort making sure that not only are they working to make sure that people are safe, but that they're doing what they can to mitigate the risk. And that means clearing dead trees and brush. It means making sure that escape routes and fire roads are clear. And one of the hugest issues, the biggest issues as it relates to that, is there is not enough money to do it properly. When CAL FIRE gets a budget, they plan out what they're going to do with that budget. But when we have fires the way that we're having them year over year, those budgets are going to fighting the fires, and the prevention aspect becomes delegated to the back burner. Or it doesn't happen at all the way it was planned to happen because they've just run out of money. And of course, there is the issue of climate change. There is all kinds of discussion about the extent of climate change and the impact that it has, but there's no doubt that climate change is real and that it is threatening our very existence. David Romps is the director of the Berkeley Atmospheric Sciences Center, and he seems to understand exactly what's going on. And as it relates to the fires that started up north after all the lightning strikes just 6 to 8 weeks ago, he said, to cut to the chase, were the heat wave and the lightning strikes and the dryness of the vegetation affected by global warming? Absolutely, yes. Were they made significantly hotter, more numerous, and drier because of global warming? Yes, likely. Yes and yes. That's pretty confident. And that's explaining that it's the combination of dryness and wind and heat and weather all coming together that is making the opportunity for these fires to be larger, more destructive, and most worrisome, more and more common. In our next podcast, we're going to talk a little bit more about the prevention aspects that we can think about as we look forward to 2021, and hopefully that year will be a lot calmer in many different respects. California Burns, the podcast, is a property of the California Fire Prevention Organization. You can visit us online at www.calfireprevention.org, and you can learn more about the California Burns digital book at www.californiaburns.org. My name is David Barrett. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you again soon.